Welcome to the premiere episode of A Closer Look at the Constitution. I'm your host, Americanism. In this episode, as the title suggests, we will be taking a closer look at Article 3 of the U.S. Constitution, analyzing each clause line by line, providing legal definitions if necessary, and the perspectives of the founders to provide insight and context to the Constitution. None of what's discussed herein should be perceived as legal counsel, nor an incitement of any description. This recording is purely educational and has no other intent than to provide a better understanding of the enumerated powers according to the framers. The citations for this episode are provided by the U.S. Constitution, the Federalist Papers, and Black's Law Dictionary. If you enjoy this content, please share this episode on Parler and help me in my crusade to preserve our nation's great history. It was incredibly difficult to decide what to include and omit for the sake of time while remaining true to the context of the cited sources. I highly recommend all listeners purchase a copy of the aforementioned and study in depth to reach their own conclusions and understandings as to what the founders in their respective documents and essays intended. Even with my most sincere efforts, it probably does not do them justice in its entirety. Even with exclusion, the essays are lengthy and should be expected to be so, knowing the intent was to dispel any misconceptions regarding the Constitution's meaning, bringing clarity for those who had reservations in supporting its ratification. In order to cover each line or clause in its entirety, we may commit an episode or more to a specific clause or line. With that said, let's get right into it after this break. Welcome back. Let's get right into a closer look at the Constitution. Article 3, Section 1. The judicial power of the United States shall be vested in one Supreme Court, and in such inferior courts as the Congress may from time to time ordain and establish. The judges of both the Supreme and inferior courts shall hold their offices during good behavior, and shall, at stated times, receive for their services a compensation, which shall not be diminished during their continuance in office. If you're wondering what some or all of that means exactly, Hamilton had this to say in Federalist No. 81, published June 25th and 28th, 1788, under the pseudonym Publius. To the people of the state of New York, let us now return to the partition of the judiciary authority between different courts and their relations to each other. Quote, "The judicial power of the United States is, by the plan of the convention, to be vested in one Supreme Court, and in such inferior courts as the Congress may from time to time ordain and establish," unquote. 1. That there ought to be one court of supreme and final jurisdiction is a proposition which is not likely to be contested. The reasons for it have been assigned in another place and are too obvious to need repetition. The only question that seems to have been raised concerning it is whether it ought to be a distinct body or a branch of the legislature. The same contradiction is observable in regard to this matter, which has been remarked in several other cases. The very men who object to the Senate as a court of impeachments, on the ground of improper intermixture of powers, advocate, by implication at least, the propriety of vesting the ultimate decision of all causes in the whole or in a part of the legislative body. The arguments, or rather suggestions, upon which this charge is founded are to this effect. Quote, "The authority of the proposed Supreme Court of the United States, which is to be a separate and independent body, will be superior to that of the legislature. The power of construing the laws according to the spirit of the Constitution will enable that court to mold them into whatever shape it may think proper, especially as its decisions will not be in any manner subject to the revision or correction of the legislative body. This is as unprecedented as it is dangerous. In Britain, the judicial power, in the last resort, resides in the House of Lords, which is a branch of the legislature. And this part of the British government has been imitated in the state constitutions in general. The Parliament of Great Britain and the legislatures of the several states can at any time rectify, by law, the exceptionable decisions of their respective courts. But the errors and usurpations of the Supreme Court of the United States will be uncontrollable and remediless." Unquote. This, upon examination, will be found to be made up altogether of false reasoning upon misconceived fact. In the first place, there is not a syllable in the plan under consideration which directly empowers the national courts to construe the laws according to the spirit of the Constitution, or which gives them any greater latitude in this respect than may be claimed by the courts of every state. I admit, however, that the Constitution ought to be the standard of construction for the laws, and that wherever there is an evident opposition, the laws ought to give place to the Constitution. But this doctrine is not deducible from any circumstance peculiar to the plan of the Convention, but from the general theory of a limited Constitution, and as far as it is true, is equally applicable to most, if not to all, state governments. There can be no objection, therefore, on this account, to the federal judicature, which will not lie against the local judicatures in general, and which will not serve to condemn every constitution that attempts to set bounds to legislative discretion. But perhaps the force of the objection may be thought to consist in the particular organization of the Supreme Court, in its being composed of a distinct body of magistrates instead of being one of the branches of the legislature, as in the government of Great Britain and that of the state. To insist upon this point, the authors of the objection must renounce the meaning they have labored to annex to the celebrated maxim, requiring a separation of the departments of power. It shall nevertheless be conceded to them, agreeably to the interpretation given to that maxim in the course of these papers, that is not violated by vesting the ultimate power of judging in a part of the legislative body. But though this be not an absolute violation of that excellent rule, yet it verges so nearly upon it, as on this account alone to be less eligible than the mode preferred by the Convention. From a body which had even a partial agency in passing bad laws, we could rarely expect a disposition to temper and moderate them in the application. The same spirit which had operated in making them would be too apt in interpreting them. Still, less could it be expected that men who had infringed the Constitution in the character of legislators would be disposed to repair the breach in the character of judges. Nor is this all. Every reason which recommends the tenure of good behavior for judicial offices militates against placing the judiciary power in the last resort in a body composed of men chosen for a limited period. There is an absurdity in referring the determination of causes, in the first instance, to judges of permanent standing, in the last, to those of a temporary immutable constitution. And there is still greater absurdity in subjecting the decisions of men selected for their knowledge of the laws acquired by long and laborious study to the revision and control of men who, for want of the same advantage, cannot be deficient in that knowledge. The members of the legislature will rarely be chosen with a view to those qualifications which fit men for the stations of judges. And as, on this account, there will be great reason to apprehend all of the ill consequences of defective information, so, on account of the natural propensity of such bodies to party divisions, there will be no less reason to fear the pestilential breath of faction may poison the fountains of justice. The habit of being continually marshaled on opposite sides will be too apt to stifle the voice of both law and equity. These considerations teach us to applaud the wisdom of the United States who have committed the judicial power in the last resort not to a part of the legislature, but to a distinct and independent bodies of men, contrary to the supposition of those who have represented the plan of the Convention in this respect as novel and unprecedented. It is but a copy of the constitutions of New Hampshire, Massachusetts, Pennsylvania, Delaware, Maryland, Virginia, North Carolina, South Carolina, and Georgia, and the preference which has been given to those models is highly to be commended. It is not true, in the second place, that the Parliament of Great Britain, or the legislatures of the particular states, can rectify the exceptionable decisions of their respective courts, in any other sense than might be done by the future legislator of the United States. The theory, neither of the British nor the state constitutions, authorizes the revisal of a judicial sentence by a legislative act, nor is there anything in the proposed constitution, more than in either of them, by which it is forbidden. In the former, as well as the latter, the impropriety of the thing on the general principles of law and reason is the sole obstacle. A legislature, without exceeding its province, cannot reverse a determination once made in a particular case, though it may prescribe a new rule for future cases. This is the principle, and it applies in all its consequences, exactly in the same manner and extent to the state governments as to the national government now under consideration. Not the least difference can be pointed out in any view on the subject. It may in the last place be observed that the supposed danger of judiciary encroachments on the legislative authority, which has been upon many occasions reiterated, is in reality a phantom. particular misconstructions and contraventions of the will of the legislature may now and then happen, but they can never be so extensive as to amount to an inconvenience or in any sensible degree to affect the order of the political system. This may be inferred with certainty from the general nature of the judicial power, from the objects to which it relates, from the manner in which it's exercised, from its comparative weakness, and from its total incapacity to support its usurpations by force. And the inference is greatly fortified by the consideration of the important constitutional check which the power of instituting impeachments in one part of the legislative body and of determining upon them in the other would give to that body upon the members of the judicial department. This alone is a complete security. There can never be a danger that the judges, by a series of deliberate usurpations on the authority of the legislature, would hazard the united resentment of the body entrusted with it, while this body was possessed of the means of punishing their presumption by degrading them from their stations. While this ought to remove all apprehensions on the subject, it affords, at the same time, a cogent argument for constituting the Senate a court for the trial of impeachments. Having now examined, and, I trust, removed the objections to the distinct and independent organization of the Supreme Court, I proceed to consider the propriety of the power of constituting inferior courts and the relations which will subsist between these and the former. The power of constituting inferior courts is evidently calculated to obviate the necessity of having recourse to the Supreme Court in every case of federal cognizance. It is intended to enable the national government to institute or authorize in each state or district of the United States a tribunal competent to the determination of matters of national jurisdiction within its limits. But why, it is asked, might not the same purpose have been accomplished by the instrumentality of the state courts? This admits of different answers, though the fitness and competency of those courts should be allowed in the utmost latitude. Yet the substance of the power in question may still be regarded as a necessary part of the plan if it were only to empower the national legislature to commit to them the cognizance of causes arising out of the national constitution. To confer the power of determining such causes upon the existing courts of the several states would perhaps be as much, quote, to constitute tribunals, unquote, as to create new courts with the like power. But ought not a more direct and explicit provision to have been made in favor of the state courts? There are, in my opinion, substantial reasons against such a provision. The most discerning cannot foresee how far the prevalency of a local spirit may be found to disqualify the local tribunals for the jurisdiction of national causes. Whilst every man may discover that courts constituted like those of some of the states would be improper channels of the judicial authority of the Union, state judges, holding their offices during pleasure or from year to year, will be too little independent to be relied upon for an inflexible execution of the national law. And if there was a necessity for confiding the original cognizance of causes arising under those laws to them, there would be a correspondent necessity for leaving the door of appeal as wide as possible. In proportion to the grounds of confidence in or distrust of the subordinate tribunals ought to be the facility or difficulty of appeals. And well satisfied as I am of the propriety of the appellate jurisdiction, in the several classes of causes to which it is extended by the plan of convention, I should consider everything calculated to give, in practice, an unrestrained course to appeals as a source of public and private inconvenience. Let us now examine in what manner the judicial authority is to be distributed between the Supreme and the inferior courts of the Union. The Supreme Court is to be invested with original jurisdiction only, quote, in cases affecting ambassadors, other public ministers, and consuls, and those in which a state shall be a party, unquote. Public ministers of every class are the immediate representatives of their sovereigns. All questions in which they are concerned are so directly connected with the public peace, that, as well for the preservation of this, as out of respect to the sovereignties they represent, it is both expedient and proper that such questions should be submitted in the first instance to the highest judicatory of the nation. Though consuls have not in strictness a diplomatic character, yet as they are the public agents of the nations to which they belong, The same observation is in a great measure applicable to them. In cases in which a state might happen to be a party, it would ill suit its dignity to be turned over to an inferior tribunal. Let us resume the train of our observations. We have seen the original jurisdiction of the Supreme Court would be confined to two classes of causes, and those of a nature rarely to occur. In all other cases of federal cognizance, the original jurisdiction would appertain to the inferior tribunals, and the Supreme Court would have nothing more than appellate jurisdiction. Quote, with such exceptions and under such regulations as the Congress shall make, unquote. Okay, if you're still listening, I just want to thank you for taking a closer look at Article 3, Section 1 with me. Let's take a moment to reflect on what Alexander Hamilton discussed. First, he gave insight into why the Federalists believed the judicial branch was a necessary third branch of the proposed national government. It's obvious. The balance of power was necessary to prevent those who were elected to propose new legislation from enacting laws that were contrary to the Constitution or were not laws necessary in pursuance thereof. It should seem obvious that allowing those who pass laws should not be allowed to interpret them as they see fit. Hamilton also expressed in his essay, should the Supreme Court judges fail to uphold that duty, or their judgment begin to reflect that of political faction rather than the constitutional scope, the constitutional check was in place to impeach them. The purpose for their wages to be guaranteed not to diminish was for two reasons. One, the fluctuations in the value of money. And for the second reason, I will quote Hamilton in number 79. Quote, in the general course of human nature, a power over a man's subsistence amounts to a power over his will. Finally, he described the distinctions between the Supreme Court and the inferior courts of the Union. The Supreme Court has original jurisdiction in cases affecting ambassadors, other public ministers, and consuls, and those in which a state shall be a party. All other cases of federal cognizance, the original jurisdiction would appertain to the inferior tribunals, and the Supreme Court would have nothing more than an appellate jurisdiction, with such exceptions and under such regulations as the Congress shall make. Unquote. Now let's take a moment to understand why the founders believed the appointment of a Supreme Court judge should be for life. For this, again, I will cite Federalist number 78. Quote, that inflexible and uniform adherence to the rights of the Constitution and of individuals, which we perceive to be indispensable in the courts of justice, can certainly not be expected from judges who hold their offices by a temporary commission. Periodical appointments, however regulated, or by whomsoever made, would, in some way or other, be fatal to their necessary independence. If the power of making them was committed either to the executive or legislature, there would be a danger of an improper complaisance to the branch which possessed it. If to both, there would be an unwillingness to hazard the displeasure of either. If to the people, or to persons chosen by them for the special purpose, there would be too great a disposition to consult popularity, to justify a reliance that nothing would be consulted but the Constitution and the laws, unquote. This should reveal to you that at conception, the idea of political judges was repugnant and toxic to the balance of powers. Well, folks, that concludes the very first episode of A Closer Look at the Constitution with your host, Americanism. Let me know your thoughts on the content on Parler and whether or not you learned anything from this episode. After all, that is the point. This is Americanism, signing off.